Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. Trent Kling and Leighton Kling with you this week. Coming up, we talk about rent-to-own chain Aaron's, who hit a reversal of their last quarter's results. We'll also discuss retail real estate once again as a big-time REIT releases their quarterly earnings. And avocados are in the news for three reasons. We'll talk about all three later on in the show. Our interview guest this week is Zach Adams, Marketing and Customer Service Manager at Crocan, who joins us to talk dynamics of utilities, specifically telephone and internet in retail, as retailers begin to bulk up their internet abilities and go towards fiber. We'll talk about different adjustments that need to be made for retailers to make that jump. A reminder to like us, rate us wherever you listen to us, and also visit us on Twitter and Instagram at Retail Podcast. Well, leading our news portion today, you know, we discussed mergers and acquisitions last week with Albertsons and Rite Aid, but now news of a potential new acquisition hits everyone's radar this week and sends the retail world abuzz and share prices skyrocketing. Reports surfaced Thursday that United Natural Foods Incorporated has entered into an agreement to buy the distributor and grocery retailer Super Value. Now, we discussed last year Super Value's recent pivot away from their retail business and towards their wholesale and distribution efforts. Super Value still has a number of brick and mortar locations, but they've primarily been investing in their distribution over the last 3 years with a lot of CapEx focused on this category. And Leighton, that might be a big reason why United Natural Foods Incorporated saw some value in Super Value.
Definitely not a lot of value with their retail banners, several retail banners throughout the United States. But like you said, Trent, all underperforming. On Thursday, shares of Super Value shot up more than 66% on this news that United Natural Foods was an interested buyer in their business. While this sounds like a lot, it really only brought back the stock to levels seen in fall of 2016. So the stock price has actually fallen precipitously over the last year and a half or so. A mismanaged, or as some would say, neglected retail business has been to blame for all the negative news surrounding the stock, with negative headlines about quarterly comps overtaking some of the positives from their growing distribution network. Another reason that shares have been depressed is their relatively high debt load. United Natural Foods intends to pay $1.3 billion for the overall business, but combined with that debt load, it's going to be about $2.9 billion in total. Not only does this deal look to expand their wholesale capacity, the larger combined company would have more access to different vendors in different parts of the United States. United Natural Foods CEO said that retailers demand this new combination wherein they're able to get more of a variety of goods and they're able to extend out their reach for a larger customer base. They estimate cost savings of approximately $175 million. But this is going to be across 3 years. This is going to help margins, obviously, but also the end consumer. If you think about it, synergies end up helping lower the cost of like goods. So overall, the goods that are going to be hitting grocery retailers that they end up distributing are going to be a little bit cheaper, and the customer should, in the end, be happier. Currently, UNFI, which is the ticker symbol for United Natural Foods, is regarded as the largest natural foods distributor inside the United States. They have primarily grown in the recent years by acquisition. Just in 2016, in fact, they bought three different food distributors and manufacturers. That tells you how aggressive they really are. So this should come as no surprise to those very closely tied to the industry. So far, UNFI has about 10 different divisions, including even a Canadian segment. So big in North America, and again, looking to expand westward in the United States. UNFI's biggest customer right now is Whole Foods, which has been getting quite the publicity since Amazon acquired that business not too long ago. This could enhance the value offering for Whole Foods as Whole Foods has attempted to lower prices and have more staple food items be lowered for their customer. Obviously, we've seen a lot of that advertising surrounding Prime Day. Last quarter, their sales to Whole Foods, UNFI's sales to Whole Foods, were up 24%. And that now makes up more than 30% of their business. Around 34% of their business is directly tied to Whole Foods and that distribution. And That number, Trent, is growing sequentially. Their current Whole Foods contract ends up expiring in 2025, and the big concern is that Amazon may think that they can distribute better or form other relationships on their own in the next 7 years. And so this is probably something that both companies are looking towards. And it seems like a long time away. 2025, you would think you would be secure, but in the meantime, you have to make sure that that relationship remains strong. And so if you're UNFI, you really have to think about how you can lower your prices and offer more products to Whole Foods in order to keep that relationship strong. And product-wise, what Super Value brings to the table is a more conventional product offering. You won't see many organic labels with what they bring to grocery stores, but they do have a considerable ethnic food portfolio.
And part of that entire portfolio that Super Value has, that's going to hedge, but also it's going to create this diversity within what UNFI can bring to the table for different businesses. And it's also going to make them not necessarily Amazon-proof were that Whole Foods contract to expire or go out of date or be allowed to not renew. But it also provides them that safety net where they'll be able to make sure they can distribute to a number of different grocers if Whole Foods, for whatever reason, does back out. And we should keep in mind, even though Whole Foods makes up a lot of UNFI's total distribution network, Super Value has a much larger portfolio in terms of customers. If you're at United Natural Foods, this adds to the number of customers you've got in your Rolodex, and anything that can make a company less dependent on a single company's buying power is what you have right now with Whole Foods is a positive thing for the company heading forward, at least in our view. Now, something that's not mentioned in the different write-ups about this deal and may or may not make a measurable impact is Super Value's ever-evolving merchandising strategy and their hands-on grocery store relationships. The last time we talked about Super Value was from an earnings call that we covered on the Food Focus podcast. What struck us the most was their highlighting of being more in-store partners with grocers rather than just dumping off a bunch of groceries at a particular grocer. They've managed to work out displays and end caps with the grocer to improve performance and seeing what labels were more attractive or not attractive. So you've seen a lot of redesign of some of their private label products. And while not entirely tangible to UNFI's future combined business, presuming this deal closes, of course, this is definitely an important wrinkle for them to remain fresh, use best practices in terms of marketing and branding that Super Value and the distribution side of Super Value now inherently has. Super Value's been growing top line sales double digits thanks to their own series of acquisitions in terms of acquisitions of distributors, of course, but they did lose $27 million last quarter while profitable just last year. Now, some of this, of course, is due to issues with their own brick and mortar holdings and some of their own retail store holdings that Leighton referenced and that we referenced to kick off the story. Despite many applauding the deal, the applause seems to be more on the end of Super Value. UNFI's shares actually dropped more than 15% on the news. So those shareholders, not so bullish about this deal, but Super Value shareholders absolutely loved it. In our view, or a lot of other people's view, it doesn't seem likely that there's going to be regulatory hurdles. There are enough distributors out there where I don't think they're going to run into antitrust concerns. There is, however, a Super Value vote for its shareholders that they expect will pass, given just how much the stock did go up, that 65%. And this would allow a before the end of the year closing. So I don't think you're going to see the shareholders maybe battle against this particular deal like you're seeing some of the Rite Aid shareholders battle against the Albertsons deal that we discussed last week.
If the two companies do come together and the shareholders approve of it, the combined access for United Natural Foods will bring to the table over 3,323 wholesale stores that source then to different retail partners. Beyond the balance sheet, there are future obligations and pieces of the business that UNFI will have to tend to. One major one being Super Value's current pension obligations. Pension obligations, as we've talked about somewhat on this podcast, are something that has bogged down legacy retailers like Sears and Kroger in the past. But for people receiving pensions, this is likely a good sign that the funding will be a little more secure in the future for the long term with a more solvent company. Obviously, Trent just talked about the losses, the recent losses that Super Value has reported on their quarterly earnings report. That is never a good sign if you are a recipient of a pension. The other will be finding a suitor for Super Value's current retail business, which we said has struggled as of late. United Natural Foods has made it clear that they want no part of maintaining the grocery retail business, despite the fact that those stores hold many of Super Value's distributed products. Super Value's retail grocery stores end up actually holding more proportionate items that they distribute than their other retail partners. So this is interesting that they want no part of it for the long term. They basically have the viewpoint that the entire retail division is underperforming despite looking at individual same-store sales, and that capital could be spent and time could be spent better elsewhere within the company. If there are not buyers for the grocery stores, they seem ready to close them sooner than later. SuperValu, in their statement, said that any divesting of the current grocery retail business would be thoughtful and economic. A little bit more gentle than UNFI's tone, this standpoint could be more or less the perspective of SuperValu's creditors and debtors more recently leading up to this announcement. The Wall Street Journal had pointed out that Blackwell's Capital, an activist investor, has been wanting a major change with inside SuperValu. They went on to criticize executive compensation here recently and pushed for 6 new board seats. The proposed changes were so big that shareholders were actually supposed to be voting on them in the next month. So this is odd timing for the company, but some question Blackwell's intent as an activist investor, which we have seen more and more of. A lot of people questioning the coming in of activist investors and really their intent. Some larger stakeholders will take a short-term approach, basically trying to extract value in the short term with not really adding much to the bottom line through new management or practices. They just want to be able to get in and get out, extract that value, and not really do a lot for the long term or the longevity of the company.
No matter what happens here, though, many, including us, we expect to see further consolidation in food manufacturing and distribution in the coming years. In the end, people may be paying less in price for food, but there will be undoubtedly some negative effects, like, for example, layoffs as you're trying to create those synergies in between companies. But I think the most interested we are in looking at this deal is not necessarily the wholesale side, but trying to figure out what's going to happen to these brick and mortar stores, who may emerge as a potential buyer for these brick and mortar stores. And this could shift the balance of power in the grocery industry, depending on who picks up the brick and mortar stores that right now aren't performing that well. So you don't figure they're going to be all too terribly expensive, but is Kroger going to pick it up? Is Albertsons going to pick them up? Maybe a third party outside of the three major giants in Walmart, Kroger, and Albertsons. Lots to look forward to on this particular deal. Now, we follow up on beleaguered rent-to-own chain Aaron's, who looked anything but beleaguered to analysts, with their second quarter earnings call this week. When we last left Aaron's, they were in the midst of a restructuring and refocusing plan, a gradual one, but it saw them closing several brick-and-mortar locations, and they were focusing more on their third-party services to other retailers. But this quarter saw them blitz analyst expectations and send their shares shooting upward over 10% in trading on Thursday. Total revenues for this quarter hit $927 million. They brought in adjusted earnings per share of 84 cents, which was a 27% increase over last year. That is remarkable considering where we're at with the economy. Keep in mind, Aaron's, or a store like Aaron's, is a negative beta retailer, which means that as the rest of the stock market goes up, their company performance usually suffers, and vice versa, simply because of the space that they're in. Another such company that's a negative beta company, like Del Taco, for example, value-priced retailers are typically in this same space, but rent-to-own retailers are particularly hurt with an economy that has a lot of expendable income in play. Analysts' expectations here for revenue were beaten by $600,000. Adjusted earnings per share was beat by 8 cents. You know, Progressive Leasing revenues, this is their retailer leasing partnership that we spoke about at the beginning of this story. They saw revenues surge 29%. This was perhaps the biggest reason that they were able to beat on earnings. New partnerships helped invoice volume grow 25% year over year. But even the traditional Aaron's business, they had a modest 5% bump in its top line, which is remarkable considering they've been closing many stores throughout the company.
Take a broad view of this company and how they performed during this most recent earnings call. You have to be pleased with their performance. And you and I were talking about their last quarter and how we think that there is a lot of potential with the progressive leasing side of the business. And if we take a quick overview, a quick refresh, if you will, of the progressive leasing side of the business, you can see that retailers that partner on the platform can sign their customers up for a loan same day. So if a customer comes in and wants to buy a big screen TV or another big ticket item, they can actually do so without going through some long application process or having to come back the next day or the next week. Progressive leasing allows customers to finance bigger ticket items with no credit needed and different payment options available for repaying the debt. There is also an instantaneous factor that customers have been really pleased with, in that they can purchase the items immediately, like I just said, after signing up on the Progressive Leasing platform. And the advertised benefit to the retailer, if you're a retailer thinking about signing up for this Progressive Leasing program, something that they offer is that they are going to have more total business. Think about it like this. If you have a customer that comes in, they can't buy something with conventional credit or some other means, then they would probably be walking away. But with this, this is going to be a new wrinkle, a new ability to pay for an item that they could not otherwise buy. And therefore, this is going to be an increased invoice, an increased amount of transaction volume for that particular retailer. So without having to look at credit score with conventional financing, this is a huge benefit for not only the consumer, but also the retailer. They mentioned that 35% of US consumers have a subprime credit score and could actually benefit from the Progressive Leasing as a result. They now have over 2,000 retailers using this service, with 31% of customers being repeat customers to the platform. And Progressive Leasing makes their money off of interest rates and fees, not really charging the retailers outright for participation. So really, you could look at this as a win-win, and you could see that because of the double-digit volume comps this latest quarter. Despite the excellent performance from Progressive Leasing, CEO John Robinson said that the acceleration of growth was actually in line with overall expectations. Normally, you would see a great earnings call such as this receive high praise from the CEO, but he said, you know what? This was in line with our expectations. We knew we were going to hit it out of the park. Management cited an 18% increase in invoices for Progressive Leasing from those retailers who have already established a relationship for at least a year or longer. That means, to their previous point, that customers are being repeat customers. They're coming in more than once. They're telling their friends about it. Therefore, the invoices for the specific retailers that they've been working with for at least a year are headed in the positive direction. Overall, there was a 6% gain in total retail doors that were participants in the program. That would be a number that you and I, Trent, would like to see a little bit higher. We were talking before airing this podcast or recording this podcast that we would like to see that in the double-digit territory as well. Over 2,000 retailers currently, that is a huge number, but I think they could go a little bit further than that, and I think it's going to be word of mouth at this point when retailers start to have sort of a network externality effect, seeing the positive benefits from this program. Despite building up a solid service infrastructure surrounding Progressive Leasing, they did see strong margins because of how they actually leverage the growth. A customer service capacity can usually proportionally outperform versus the personnel numbers that they have, meaning that the personnel either work more efficiently or the software upgrades and automation updates end up making it a little bit easier for the customer service personnel to work and deal with more customers in a more timely fashion. The one downside was the defaults from this Progressive Leasing side of things, or what they call the bad debt and write-offs area. This increased sequentially, but were in line with expenses and what they were expecting overall. Default rates are likely somewhat to plateau, as individuals are not going to be able to qualify in the future for more Progressive Leasing programs if they exhibit a poor payback track record. Obviously, they're not going to be able to qualify for another TV if they didn't even pay off their first one, let's say. What is most important is they did also see more people doing early paybacks with a 90-day early buyout option that they have listed as a viable way of paying back an item, which actually hurts margins because when you pay something back a little bit sooner, you take in less interest, you take in less fees. So in general, it's interesting in that if you look at the dynamic overall, there's been an increase in both of the extremes. People that either are a little bit more responsible or less responsible for the retail goods that they purchased on a particular platform. They're either trying to pay it off a little bit sooner to save money, or they're just not paying it off at all.
Let's transition to the Aaron's part of the business, the retail part of the business. And I know Aaron surprised us the most. It certainly surprised me when I saw their earnings call. I figured Progressive Leasing was going to do well. But seeing Aaron's do as well as they did, having their margins come in better than expected and their business being solid for the most part, was astounding to me. They spoke highly of the e-commerce initiatives that have made the website easier to navigate. They actually said on the call they feel like the online direct-to-consumer market in their niche is largely underserved. Their personnel and strategy have also aligned on the Aaron's side, so they expect continued positive momentum now that they've kind of reorganized the company as a whole. Overall, Aaron saw strength in many of the categories that have been historically the strongest. I think the most notable thing for Aaron's coming out of this earnings call is the fact that ticket size has increased. At the same time, invoices are down. Ticket size was boosted, so people are going for larger purchases rather than the smaller rent-to-own items. Operating expenses were higher because they have been buying out franchise locations. Also, fuel costs, which is a big input cost for the individual locations as they both deliver and pick up defaulted furnishings and entertainment items, picking up, of course, the defaulted items and sending out or delivering the items that have been newly purchased. Fuel costs hurting those individual outlets because of those last mile services. Like with the Progressive Leasing side of the business, write-offs from defaults, those were up for Aaron, something you didn't expect to see on this particular call. Write-off expenses hit 4% of total lease revenue, which actually isn't as bad as one might think for a business like this, but it is up year over year. They said promotions are largely to blame and that they're bringing in more customers, but in the long term, the bigger customer base pays for the increased rate in defaults, so a more favorable return on investment with these promotions that are coming in. When you cast a wider net, it stands to reason that you're going to have more people in that wide net defaulting. The company did return $50 million to shareholders through share buybacks, and they have $94 million in cash on hand, some of which will be used to reinvest into their Aaron's omni-channel aspirations that they now have and that are growing stronger. Speaking of ongoing business investments, they've actually aggressively hired and maintained a 7-day-a-week support staff for Progressive Leasing. So as you see the numbers at Progressive Leasing grow, so too is their employment base. Shares have garnered 8% growth over the last 52 weeks for Aaron's. However, all of that has been attributable to about the last 7 months. Shares are up 9% since the beginning of the year, and especially up recently. Again, we talked about it. They were boosted by about 10% in trading on Thursday after that earnings call. Coming up after the music, we'll have our interview guest this week, Zach Adams, Marketing and Customer Service Manager at Crocan. We'll discuss retail from a utility standpoint, at least as far as internet and telephone is concerned. The subject we don't talk a whole lot about on the Retail Focus podcast is utilities. And we're joined now by Zach Adams. He's with Crocan, which is a fiber and telephone cooperative. He's a marketing and customer service manager at Crocan, and he's here to discuss how retailers are using utilities not only in the digital age, but the fiber age. In fact, Crocan is one of many regional providers throughout the country rolling out fiber to their service area and upgrading retailers and other businesses with faster internet, of course, in the process. Zach, thanks so much for joining us today on the Retail Focus podcast.
Yeah, I appreciate it, Trent. Thanks for having me on.
All right, so if you could kind of spell out for us, what's the current state of internet in most retail stores?
Well, the current state, especially in small town rural America, is they're somewhat underserved. You know, you get outside of the major cities, there are a lot of areas that still do not have a provider that offers the type of speed necessary to do business the way business is done now. You know, a lot of things are moving to the cloud. So I would say the current state is, while some areas are fortunate to have a provider that can offer the services they need, there's still a lot that really don't, and they could really use a boost and a good upgrade.
Now, I know you work with this stuff every day, so you probably know a little bit more about countrywide the status of where everything is than we do. You mentioned some metropolitan areas obviously have fiber, have strong internet, but are there still areas with significant population that might be underserved by fiber as well?
You know, it kind of depends on your definition of underserved, but what you hear about in the media a lot now, you know, the Google Fiber project, right? You know, and AT&T bumping up their own fiber gigabit product and some of the larger nationwide carriers with millions of customers. But what you don't hear a lot about is what's kind of known as the digital divide. And that is kind of those places where there's still significant numbers of people who are on legacy, you know, copper transmission lines that are not equipped. Maybe they're working fine now, but they're not equipped for the demand, bandwidth demands in the future that's coming down the pipe. Yeah.
We talk every week about some of these demands, whether it be e-commerce fulfillment in stores or otherwise. Now, as far as upgrading a retailer, let's say a retailer reaches out to you or another ISP somewhere in the country and says, hey, we want to upgrade to fiber. Is it onerous on their end? Do they need to upgrade certain equipment to be able to get there? Or is it more or less on the utility side of things?
There are a couple of questions to answer that first that you have to know. First is, does this company offer a gigabit offering? Okay, so a gigabit is 1,000 megabits. For the last 15 to 20 years, internet speeds have been mostly measured in megabits per second, whereas a gigabit is 1,000 megabits per second. So to first, you got to make that distinction. Network infrastructure that hasn't been upgraded or completely upgraded from wiring to switches to routers to handle that level of speed could mean that you could actually subscribe to a package that your internal infrastructure can't handle. So that's the first question is, can the businesses own routers, switches, and networking equipment all the way down to the devices connecting to it? Can they handle a gigabit connection? That is if a company is even offering gigabit yet, because not all of them are, or it's at a price point that's not quite obtainable for a small business. So that's kind of the first part of that. The second part to your question is, as far as disruption to the business, once the pipe or the fiber or the copper, whatever the transmission line medium is being brought to the building, it can run in simultaneous nature with the existing provider. So if you're making a switch to a separate provider, generally when we hook somebody up, we make sure everything is up and tested and running before we will switch over from one service provider to the other. Now, if it's a service provider upgrading equipment, it could mean a bit of downtime. So that's the first thing is, one, are you ready for the type of service you're going to be upgrading to? And two, is it another company or an existing company changing their service?
So you've kind of already walked us through a little bit of the shell of the process, but we know so many retailers now are upgrading their internet, trying to upgrade their infrastructure basically to handle a new age of digital customers. So from your perspective, what is the process like when you sit down and first meet with a retailer that maybe wants to bolster their equipment and make sure that they can answer to that customer?
Sure. So the first question I ask is, what are you doing with it? If all you need is a commuter to get you across town, I don't need to sell you a Lamborghini, right? So, you know, in the case of the flower shop with a front desk employee, no public Wi-Fi, if they've already got a 50 meg connection, I hate to not take a customer, but if you're not needing what we're selling, I'd be glad to find you something comparable over, you know, a new technology. But that's the first question I always ask is, where is your need? What is your need and what is not being met that you need to make? And in some cases, it is more speed, but in other cases, it's a reliability question. So that's the first thing that I ask.
Going beyond that, let's say we have just hypothetically a grocery store, maybe a neighborhood grocery store, they're upgrading to fiber. What are some of the things you need to make sure and check with the grocery store from your perspective, but also the grocery store's owner's perspective? What questions should they be asking before they make the switch or upgrade or attempt to upgrade?
So the one thing that we run into quite often are people who have maybe firewalls that don't have the capacity to handle a gigabit connection. So we will get trouble calls in saying, hey, well, I'm only getting 100 meg. Well, you could do a little bit of investigation and find out it's equipment on site. The first thing really is that infrastructure question. And the second thing, what level of service do they require?
So you mentioned the flower shop example, how they may not need more than a 50 meg package, but for a larger retailer or for a retailer that feels like they need something else, what other than the faster internet speed, what other benefits can they realize from that fiber connection?
So there are a lot of benefits to having a fiber optic connection. And depending on the deployment of the network, if it's aerial, strung across poles versus buried, you know, you can get a reliability factor. So our network is 100% buried. So you're not susceptible to those weather type of events like a lot of aerial run cable is. So the reliability factor is one. The longevity of that cable, I believe the lifespan of a buried fiber is about 30 years. The maximum available bandwidth is dependent on the optics, which transmits the light down the fiber. So it future-proofs you. So you, while you may not need it now, it does future-proof your business for what may have not come out yet. You know, there was a time when everybody thought, oh, you guys are hooking people up with a megabit per second. Why would we ever need that? You know, in the dial-up days, and we'll never use that. And now we're talking gig, you know, so it's kind of a crazy occurrence. We always have a tendency to underestimate what you might need in the future.
Speaking of the future, you guys provide telephone service as well as a company. And I know, generally speaking, I don't want to overgeneralize, but we're seeing a little bit less phone traffic in terms of going to retailers because people can go to websites, people can go to apps, that type of thing. E-commerce sites now exist. But that being said, where have you seen phone service go kind of over the last 10 to 20 years? And why is it important for a retailer to still have that phone line there?
Well, we're kind of seeing, a renaissance in phone service, right? So there, for a while, the big push is everything digital. Remove all the friction, and friction came to be known as the people involved, right? So it was, let's push to make everything is automated and everything is digital and I never have to talk to anyone. Well, now what we're seeing in businesses, they want to recapture that personalized spirit, and they do that with having a live person at the end of that line. And so now we're getting a lot more people are saying, hey, now what is the call quality on this line? Because, you know, we want to be heard well and we want to be able to talk reliably without getting disconnected. And the technology now that is used by most companies to deploy voice over fiber is voice over IP technology, which in the past is, you know, it had not had a great reputation for being very good quality, and it's really matured. And now it's just as good as any POTS system or plain old telephone system that's been around forever. And so it is interesting to see as well here, you know, not too long ago, the push was to drive out every phone line and we don't ever want to have to talk to a customer. And now people are like, hey, we want to have hunt groups where we can answer all of our calls live and not send them to automated call handling systems. And so it's kind of been interesting in that respect.
What's next for utilities as far as retailers are concerned? I know you don't deal a ton with electric and water and that type of thing, but from the utilities that you guys manage, what's next on the retail frontier?
You kind of say it right there. It's a utility, right? Because like the electric, you don't really care what company that you get as long as it's always on, there's enough of it there, and it's reliable, and it does what it's supposed to do. So what's next? Fiber is a technology that is still being improved in certain aspects, but it'll be across the same technology for the immediate future. There are labs that are testing immensely faster speeds than we're seeing now that should be able to, you know, I think I read one article, basically transmit the entire internet in a matter of minutes instead of years. You know, that's the type of step up, and that's over existing physical technology. So the physics, while being upgraded, are still going to be transmitted across fiber optic lines for the foreseeable future. So what I foresee in the future is not so much a change in technology from a utility type service provider, but a much, much greater focus on the customer service aspect of it. Because anybody, once the fiber's in the ground, anybody can offer the same technology and the same type of speeds and packages across that. So I think what you'll see is an industry that's historically been rated the worst customer service experience of any industry over and over, like year in and year out, are ISPs and cable companies. Because, you know, you've got to have them, or the perception is you got to have them, and they're the only game in town, and they treat you terribly. And, you know, I feel like we're kind of on the forefront of that, had been trying to change that culture for a long time. And I think that that's what you're going to see more and more nationwide, even with the really big carriers, because as they start moving in on each other, you're going to start seeing that competitive nature not be who's going to roll out the best technology. It's going to be who's going to treat their customers the best. I really think that's where it's going.
Yeah, reliability, price, obviously playing into that as well. Might be really good for the retailers' bottom lines going forward. Well, Zach Adams, once again with Crawcan, marketing and customer service manager there. Thank you so much for joining us and joining us on short notice, no less.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. You know, I'm always up for a little impromptu talk about something I've been involved with for a long time. And it's one of those things that we always have our head buried in it day in and day out. We don't realize that people just don't know all of this stuff. It's good to, I think, throw some opinions and knowledge out there to help people learn the same thing. So
absolutely. A lot of people take it for granted, and perhaps we shouldn't going forward, or we should at least assess how we're doing it going forward. Well, after the music coming up, we're going to talk a little retail real estate. ¶¶
Anytime we talk about real estate and combine it with retail on this podcast, it is definitely something that excites me. This time through the lens of Retail Opportunity Investment Corp, who reported their second quarter earnings results on Wednesday of this week. It is a publicly traded REIT, ticker ROIC, specializing in retail, as the name suggests. So they are going to be on this podcast, and it's interesting because all of their holdings are in retail. A lot of other REITs have a broad portfolio of retail investment, but end up having maybe 10 or 15% office spaces or an apartment complex or two. Not for this company. Major analysts have been saying, based on rent rates and occupancy rates as of late, that industrial and office spaces have far outperformed retail this year. This is true if you look at the big macro. However, all of the commercial real estate has remained fairly strong in the U.S., so every different sector has been performing fairly strong. One weak point, if you could point to a weak point, is B minus in C class retail areas, whereas A-class retail has done rather well. You can think of A-class retail as a shopping center that is anchored by, say, a Whole Foods and many anchors such as Lululemon or Pottery Barn. For ROIC, they don't stray away from much what they would call necessity-based retail. Their shopping centers, like our Whole Foods example, are anchored by grocery stores and pharmacies such as CVS. CVS, just to name one partner they have or one tenant they have, they also have Walmart Neighborhood Market, Trader Joe's, Kroger, Kohl's, among others. They have a ton of big name retailers such as The Gap. And honestly, Trent, their presence is very powerful. These very necessity-based, as they call it, retail centers are extremely popularized. A lot are newer, just created in the last 10 or 15 years or so. Their target demographic is middle and upper class income areas and larger cities. Densely populated cities is something that they mention on their website a lot. In western parts of the U.S., they do business. Washington, Oregon, and California are their three primary target areas. They are headquartered in San Diego, California. On their website, which I just mentioned, it's roireit.net. You can see all of their properties in good detail. A very impressive website. If you are a prospective investor, you can see the number of units per center, who is there in terms of what retailers are there, how they are performing, and any current vacancies for that applicable center. So their funds from operations this year hit $33.4 million as we get into the numbers, or around 27 cents per share. Instead of straight income, funds from operations, a number we use a lot in REITs talking about their financial performance, adds back in amortization and depreciation expense to give you a better view of how they're performing financially. Analysts had expected 2 cents per share better on the bottom line. FFO, or funds from operations, would have, in fact, been a little bit better and more in line with analyst expectations if there weren't delays with some new tenants coming online. They have around $7 million that's in waiting that they'll have to record in the third quarter due to some leasing permitting issues that we will touch on in a bit from the greater Northwest. Straight net income was $7.3 million, or around 6 cents per share. The REIT's second quarter revenue hit $72.3 million. Those are a lot of rent payments, Trent, coming in $600,000 short of analyst expectations. Year over year, though, the main positive for them is that their properties that they have owned for at least 1 year, net operating income increased 2.8%. And so, as a lot of us know, net operating income is a function of two things. You either have an increase in rents or a decrease in expenses, such as taxes and insurance. This is actually largely a factor of the former. Rent growth has been huge for them. In fact, 26 straight quarters of NOI growth from properties owned at least 1 year, and a lot of that is attributable to rent increases. Every time they sign a renewal, rent increase. Every time they get a new tenant, rent increase. So a lot of positives for this company if you look at the bottom line. A total occupancy rate of 97.5% is much, much better than the national retail occupancy rate that hovers between 90 and 91%. 41 shopping centers that they currently have are 100% leased. 42 total new leases this quarter, seeing double-digit lease rate hikes on average. 55 new lease renewals, totaling 167,000 square feet.
And even though their revenue did miss analyst expectations, there is a lot to like. First of all, the occupancy rate. Second of all, the fact that they've actually been able to execute on increasing the amount per square foot on these leases. And this flies in the face of what we've seen some retail CEOs claim is that they feel like they're going to be able to negotiate lease prices down. Well, the exact opposite is happening with this particular company. CEO Stuart Tanz, who has led several commercial real estate companies, both public and private, had mostly positive things to say about the business when on the earnings call. They were pleased especially with the rate of renewal with their bigger tenants. They were able to extract growth in rents in most cases. And despite the fact that analysts were questioning them on their rates per square foot, they responded that their rates per square foot are in line or above industry averages at this point. They did cite strong, unchanged demand across their portfolio, which again is key. And they talked about taking a more conservative path for acquisitions. So we're seeing the acquisitions for this company slow down a little bit. In the Western territories, particularly California, commercial real estate definitely at a premium. I was looking through Arizona commercial real estate during this week. That's also at a premium. You're seeing some huge prices come in for commercial real estate. Makes it difficult for these firms to acquire new complexes. Not uncommon to see a fully leased shopping center at a 5% cap rate, which is well lower than what one would think for the national average. Oftentimes you see even Dollar Generals and Family Dollar locations selling at a 7% cap rate. So a fully leased shopping center at a 5% cap rate is an extraordinarily high price. And much of this is due to international investment and institutional investment as well. In terms of, again, Retail Opportunity Investment Corporation, they cited hesitation in both the first and second quarters in regards to both the buying and the selling side. They feel like their current investments right where they want them to be, no reason to divest them. And they're having trouble finding investments where it makes sense to jump in at cap rates like that. They did, however, end up buying one shopping center during the quarter in the Pacific Northwest. This marks the second total acquisition in 2018 for them, both in the Pacific Northwest, this one in Seattle and the other one in Portland. And they bought them fully leased, but they feel like the value add proposition is the ability to raise rent. So rather than buying a retail complex that might be 80% leased up and the value proposition there is that you can get the other 20% leased up, in this circumstance, they're 100% leased up, but there may be some contracts that can be extended or they can go ahead and sign leases at a higher rent rate for the future, and that's where the profit comes in for them, and that's where the solid investment. Now, obviously, rents tend to be a little less sticky with the better class of shopping center that you have. A well-established neighborhood grocer, for example, cannot easily just get up and move when their term is up, leaving them sort of at the mercy of the landlord because that is expensive. So the landlord can bake in some of those lease rate hikes. They cited how they have, for the first time, gotten proposals by prospective tenants to take over a space when another tenant's lease is up in over a year. They said that while this is a new scenario for them to have people basically beating down that door, seeing that kind of demand for spaces, they're actually really excited to leverage that demand for higher rents from existing tenants. And if they reject, have someone else in tow. Now, one thing CFO Michael Haynes noted on the earnings call was how slow some permitting processes are in the Pacific Northwest, where the tenants and landlords have to formally apply with the municipalities that they are in business together. That's a wrinkle that we don't often hear about when you talk about an acquisition of a shopping center. It's not as simple in these places as just signing a property over and signing the leases over. Now, one other thing that came up on the earnings call in terms of building out, they have been eyeing other sites, but they're waiting patiently for that right deal to emerge. Reiterated several times, the cautious approach, the patient approach is best with their current outlook. And we have to ask, with the experience their executive team has, do they see the interest rates having an effect potentially on cap rates? With interest rates going up, and earlier this year, higher interest rates were not directly correlated with any particular movement. Apartments and office properties actually saw some compression, whereas industrial and retail cap rates did increase in February. One of the reasons we're seeing cap rates on acquisitions such as these still hover in the single digits.
Some argue that there may be a lagging effect from the increases in the federal funds rate. Everyone talks about what the Fed is going to do. How many more rate increases are going to take place in 2018? And how is that going to affect different REITs? Obviously, like Trent just mentioned, apartments, office properties, retail complexes, industrial complexes, such a different dynamic in all parts of the country. Some are growing more than others. Banks are still trying to be competitive in their commercial loan packages as well. And demand for properties is still high, despite what management said about the sluggish movement out west in terms of buyers and sellers sort of hesitating right now, seeing what the market is going to be doing in the next 1 to 2 years. Perhaps if there was a big shock to the system, we could see prices in retail complexes cut. Just like if you see a shock to the stock market, for instance, those sitting on the sidelines waiting patiently see that as a buying opportunity. However, the more successful REITs are smartly levered right now, so they do have cash on hand, such as this one. So it is doubtful that there would be too many shopping center fire sales, because all of the big Class A shopping centers are actually owned by responsible REITs that have a lot of cash on hand that aren't too levered in terms of perhaps having 80% debt to equity ratios and that sort of thing. A lot of REITs are smarter and have less than a 60% debt to equity ratio. Because of their strong portfolio management here and patience on the acquisition side, they have a rather strong balance sheet as well. They have $1.5 billion in debt outstanding, which sounds like a lot, but they make the point to mention that 94% of it is actually unsecured debt, so that's a good thing. That percent will actually go up as they retire another $9 million in mortgage debt in the third quarter. This is what was most interesting to me, at least, in that the majority of their debt is not mortgage debt. Mortgage debt is secured debt. That is debt that actually goes with the company in terms of if they fall on hard times, they have to be accountable for that. No fixed rate debt maturing for 4 years. That's another good thing for their balance sheet. What is interesting is that they are raising capital by selling shares in order to even more aggressively pay down debt. So they're choosing to pay down debt and not acquire new properties. $25 to $50 million in equity will be issued this year. When asked by analysts if they are selling shares because of their relatively higher market cap in terms of their stock performance as of late, management basically said, absolutely yes. We do keep our eyes on what the market is doing in terms of our share price. Those shares, ticker again, ROIC, were down briefly after Wednesday's release, but bounced back fairly quickly. They closed on Thursday around $18.75 a share, a bit down from a year ago levels of around $20, though. 20-week lows near $16, current market cap of around $2.1 billion, around $3.9, $3.8 billion if you factor in all of their debt. 4.16 dividend yield. That is not a bad dividend yield, but we have seen better as of late. We've seen actually 5 to 6% dividend yields for other comparative REITs. However, looking at the performance most recently in terms of the occupancy rates and how they've been able to extract rent increases, I think this is a good company for the long term. I'm not an advocate, nor am I a shareholder for the company, but you and I both, Trent, seem to be impressed with the website, with their investor relations, and how transparent they are about going forward in the near term.
We completely shift gears from real estate and go to the produce section, where avocados are in the news as far as retailers are concerned for three reasons. These reasons are of import not only to grocers and retailers, but also to restaurants. First, Costco and regional grocery chain Harps are both testing a new technology to attempt to keep avocados fresh longer in grocery stores. Second, a major produce packaging firm attempts to upgrade marketing and packaging for avocados in retail stores. And third, Chipotle credits avocados for a beat on earnings this week. First, we'll start with that technology that we talked about in Costco and Harps. Appeal, which is spelled A-P-E-E-L, is a product that will, in theory, protect fruits from going bad as quickly in retail stores, and it's being tested on avocados as recently as this month. Retail food, according to a press release surrounding this launch, accounts for 8 million tons of food waste annually in distribution centers or in retail stores, $18 billion in shrink. So how this works, basically, Appeal uses a material akin to the existing skin or peel of a fruit to do two different things. One is to prevent oxidation, which can cause browning like what you see in bananas, and early ripening. And the second is to prevent water loss, which can dry out the fruit at the same time causing spoilage. According to Appeal's website, the technology can keep fruit fresh for 2 to 3 times longer than fruit untreated. Obviously, the technology is of interest to grocery stores as a mechanism to reduce spoilage-related shrink, but Appeal also claims that refrigeration isn't necessary or as necessary for treated fruit. Thereby, it saves on electricity and freight costs. For those concerned about the safety of a coating, the Appeal product is made from plant-derived materials, mostly lipids and glycerolipids. They suggest that their product comes largely from peels and seeds that would otherwise go unused after a fruit is processed, so they're able to take some of the byproducts that come after a fruit is processed and make this technology and make this coating. Additionally, for what it's worth, Appeal is fully compliant with FDA regulations in the, and I quote, generally recognized as safe category. And that's, if you're not familiar with FDA regulations, that's about as safe as something can get in the FDA's rating system. So let's discuss this trial now with the Appeal avocados. All the avocados for Harps' trial are supplied by EcoFarms in California. If you're unfamiliar with Harps, they have 88 locations throughout Arkansas, Missouri, Kansas, and the surrounding Lower Plains area. Harps themselves have seen remarkable growth out of the same Northwest Arkansas corridor that Walmart is based out of, around Bentonville, Fayetteville, and the like. They in fact bought several of the old Walmart Express locations and opened Harps grocery stores on a smaller format in those. Costco's avocados in this trial, they're from Del Rey Avocados in Fallbrook, California. Now, the avocados are only available at Costco locations in the Midwest currently, although they do have plans for expansion. In fact, James Rogers, Appeal's CEO, said they will, and I quote, aggressively expand within the avocado space for both Harps and Costco, eventually hoping for nationwide penetration for both retailers. Now, in case you're wondering, if you're going to a retail store, whether or not you have an Appeal avocado in your hand, look for a special sticker with the Appeal brand on it. Now, I recently visited a Harps in Missouri. No such avocados yet. There are potential issues with scaling this technology, though, and we should warn that although the technology looks neat and they've got a lot of time-lapse videos on their website that show the impact, which is really quite amazing, of this particular spray, there are issues with it. First is that the spray can only currently be applied at the packing house. So fruits and vegetables that are packed in the field, greens, for example, a lot are packed in the field, cannot be sprayed with Appeal because they don't have a field applicator yet. Second, it appears as though the company will have to find ways to scale up remarkably in order to reach the entirety of grocery retail, given their rollout is limited to avocados in just 2 store chains. It was noted by Appeal in that same release that there won't likely be an added cost to the consumer for Appeal products, so those avocados aren't going to cost you anymore, because the cost of application is offset in theory by the reduction in shrink for a particular product. And you could actually argue that because you'll have more of that particular product on hand, you're not throwing as much of it away, you may end up with a glut of a particular product, and pricing could potentially go down on certain things like avocados, for example. They're also testing Appeal on mangoes, cassava root, citrus, and asparagus. And they do have time-lapse videos, as I mentioned, on their website that feature peppers, bananas, strawberries as well. This could be a game-changing technology if it works, if it's received well, and if it fits within the bottom line. So we're certainly keeping a close eye on how this will develop in both Harps and Costco.
We transition to a new packaging innovation, or more of a branding differentiation, from ProduceRetailer.com, who had an interesting write-up and look inside a company that is trying to change the way consumers view the avocado purchase at the grocery store. A lot in recent years has had to do with branding inside grocery stores. How do you differentiate almonds, for instance? An almond is an almond, but you have to look at the packaging in order to capture that consumer's attention. A company called Westpac looks to refresh the conventional avocado packaging with bright new colors. Green, yellow, and red will be featured on a new line of similar avocado products in store. The marketing will be centered around new slogans, which makes us remember how genius it was with initiatives that came from wonderful branded nuts. So a lot of those kinds of things have been happening in the retail industry, but we don't talk a lot about it in terms of the produce innovations. Sayings such as the golden state of avocados and I love avocados and little avocados are going to be featured on packages from this company called Westpac. The second two will actually hit the shelves in 2019 with the Golden State of Avocados package to be rolled out extensively in the next month or so in the state of California. Westpac's marketing manager said that the different retailers will have an option to actually choose which avocado package they want to have in their store. So basically, this package is going to hold, let's say, 8 to 10 avocados. They're all going to be the same thing, except the packaging is going to be a little bit different on each particular one. And the retail managers, the grocery store managers, will actually have the ability to choose which package fits their store base. So basically letting them decide which one they think customers will take a liking to, more so to increase their individual store sales. Overall, they are looking to take over the millennial demographic by not only the catchy slogans, but also smaller messaging with inside the designs. For instance, the avocado pit on the design is actually going to be heart-shaped so as to catch the attention of younger demographics. So far, management in the marketing department has said the initial feedback has been outstanding and that people just need reintroduced to something that has already proven out the health benefits and a solid flavor profile for most people. So obviously everybody knows that an avocado carries healthy fats, but a lot of people view the avocado as this sort of a side thing, something that you would maybe make guacamole out of, but they're trying to convey that you can put avocado on nearly everything and that it's a healthy addition to whatever entree or side dish you're going to have. And we move on, Trent, to Chipotle. And one wouldn't think Chipotle's earnings were up solely because of avocados, but if you read the headlines, that is almost the thought that you would have, as Chipotle shares end up rallying as they beat on earnings this week. And although we won't talk about their earnings in great detail on the show, it bears noting that a big reason why the food input prices are going down was because of avocados.
Indeed, their food costs were down 150 basis points from last year's second quarter, and avocados, they said, were the main driver, helping to offset steak and barbacoa prices increasing. They do, however, expect avocado prices to go up for them in the third quarter as California avocados begin to make their way into restaurants. California avocados usually hit stores about this time of year, and they will run until the fall. Chipotle then expects prices to go back down in the fourth quarter, with more sourcing coming in the fourth quarter and then the first quarter from Mexico. Now, although avocados were only mentioned briefly on the call, as Leighton mentioned, they did grab headlines, and it's notable that they were going in the opposite direction of many produce items currently. In fact, the price surge on avocados last year as a result of a California shortage was declared over by Bloomberg in December, but we did see prices continue to escalate in January and February before falling off. And it happened in May. Chicago Tribune reported that wholesale prices for Haas avocados from Mexico down 25% over 2017, marking the final fall off of some of those high prices from last year. So a new potential covering for these avocados, keeping them from spoiling or going bad so quickly, a new packaging to try and sell those avocados more quickly, and lower prices. Seems like it's a good time to be an avocado in U.S. retail stores.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus podcast, where each Leighton and I take a look ahead at one story we're keeping an eye on over the next week, month, or year. And we've talked about some stories already that we're planning on keeping an eye on, including that acquisition that we led off the show with, Super Value. But I know, Leighton, you're looking at something that once again ties in real estate.
Yeah, Overstock.com, what you would think is a legacy e-commerce retailer, ends up making a push into real estate. And this is interesting because they've actually done it once before. They had a brokerage business back in 2008, sort of a retail search site, if you will, and they shut that down in 2011. This time, the online retailer is looking to start what they call O Real Estate, a new website in September. So not that far off. It's actually going to be a portal for landlords for renting and buying and managing real estate as well. So they're actually going to have a property management portion of the site. And this is interesting because this is an e-commerce retailer trying to launch a system or a platform where you have rent payments coming in. You can advertise real estate or commercial real estate that's being listed throughout the country. And you can sort of have this as a platform where people can communicate with one another. This is very interesting because you wouldn't think that Overstock.com would be focused in this particular way for real estate. Their main focus should be e-commerce and their day-to-day operations there. But they said, and I quote, "For nearly 20 years, Overstock has connected customers with premium home goods, helping them build their dream homes. Now we look forward to expanding those services in the real estate industry." And this was a quote by Seth Moore, their senior VP of strategy at Overstock.com. He said that they're always looking for ways to leverage their technology, and adding real estate to the mix was a natural fit for their brand. Trent, is it just me, or that just does not seem natural for me? I feel as though their money could be spent better elsewhere, but I am curious to see how this pans out. Obviously, since their history with having a real estate business in 2008, a real estate search site, like I just said, that may help them going forward with this, but I am curious to see how it pans out and how much resources they're willing to put forth to make this a success.
It may be at the cost of their regular e-commerce business. You're right, Leighton. Well, I'm looking ahead at a story that has me scratching my head as well from Walmart this week at a time when the birth rate in the U.S. has been unremarkable and, in fact, has been hitting lows in some areas. Walmart releases a new nursery collection for young children and newborns, more specifically online. And I think the question has to be asked, will anyone notice? They released a press release. A few people said Walmart's going after Babies R Us market share, but really what Walmart's done is release several bedroom sets for these, again, newborns and young children. And they're pouring their resources into this on their e-commerce site at a time when we're seeing, again, fertility rates fairly low. In fact, the number of births in the U.S. dropped by 2% between 2016 and 2017, expected to drop even more this year. The fertility rate is at all-time lows in the U.S. And in fact, there's some concern that it's not going to reach replacement level. Replacement level fertility rates thought to be 2.1 children per couple, but now 1.76 in the United States in 2017. So the real question is this a smart investment for Walmart to be jumping in to baby furniture and baby products when we've already seen one baby retailer go out of business? Bye Bye Baby already exists and already has a huge amount of the market share. How many people are really going to go to Walmart's e-commerce site and purchase these products, especially when there's so many other competitors out there in the e-commerce realm, not unlike Overstock and other companies like Wayfair as well? And again, it's just like Leighton with Overstock. I kind of question long-term whether this is a good use of resources for Walmart. I think a far more proper use of resources right now would have been maybe a pet room complement or something along those lines. We've talked about retailers really bolstering out their pet section. That's because people are spending more on their pets than they're spending on their kids. And part of that's because they're not having as many kids anymore. So anxious to see where this goes from Walmart. And we'll be watching this website over the next couple of years to see if this is something that just quietly goes by the wayside and they shed it off, as Walmart's not shy of doing with new initiatives, or if it has some staying power. Well, that'll do it for this episode of the Retail Focus Podcast. Again, big thanks to our interview guest today, Zach Adams with Crawcan. And we will be back 1 week from now with another slate of retail news and an interview.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.